Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and here with me, talking about time machines and whether that should be a higher priority on our invention list than figuring out how to be in two or three places at once, is Ian Millhiser.
If I were a funder, I would fund time machines way before I funded being in multiple places in the present.
Ian, you're wrong. You're wrong. You're just wrong. But it's okay. You don't have my calendar. So Ian Millhiser, who's not actually here to talk about these things. He is the justice editor at Think Progress. He is also the author of Injustices, Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted.
The Supreme Court's history of comforting the comfortable and afflicting the afflicted.
You know, I said that with such gumption because I was like, I've got this right. And I had this smirk on my face and then I didn't get it right. Okay.
Yeah. All you listeners need to know is just Google Injustices in my last name. It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever major pals, wherever major books are sold.
Because Ian is our justice correspondent and our Supreme Court correspondent, I think our listeners are probably aware of your book, Ian. They've heard it enough times, botched though I may have done the title.
One more time, the title is Injustices.
So, Ian, we have you on not to talk about time machines, although if you were to take a time to get in a time machine and go back 51 years, you would be there for the signing of the Voting Rights Act, August 6th.
That's right.
So happy VRA.
Or at least for what's left of it.
For
right
what's
now.
Left of it, yes. But that's actually why we wanted to have you on, was to talk to us a little bit about where voting rights stand today. There's been a lot of news, actually a lot of really good news out of the courts recently. But before we get to what you describe in a recent piece for Think Progress as an orgy of good news when it comes to voting rights, your words.
Everyone loves an orgy of good news.
Your words, not mine. We're a family show here at Talk Poverty Radio.
Rebecca, you and I both know that's not true.
But before we get to this this aforementioned orgy, give us a little bit of history about how we even got to the Voting Rights Act, why it was put in place. I think it takes us back to Jim Crow.
Right. So I think the important thing to understand is that lawmakers who want to prevent people from voting are extraordinarily clever, and they have a history of being very, very creative. So you had an arms race in the Jim Crow era where a state would put in place a whites-only primary where you could only vote in the primary election if you were white, and it would get struck down. So they'd find a new way to have a white primary, and that would get struck down. So they'd put in place a literacy test, or they'd put in place a poll tax, or they, in some cases, they would literally physically move the location where you went to register to vote and only tell the white people where it was. They were extraordinarily creative. And what happened is that even though the courts were striking a lot of these measures down, what they found was that the vote suppressors were too nimble. They were able to come up with a new way to keep black people from voting faster than the courts could strike down the old ways.
And to be clear, although it's somewhat stating the obvious, but I think helpful for the history lesson, right, as you describe, the obstacles that they were coming up with and so nimbly were ones that on their face didn't seem to be discriminatory, right? So a literacy test or a poll tax, it doesn't say anything about black people.
That was often the case. I mean, certainly that was the case with the examples that you describe, and it would target people because they were poorer, because they were less likely to have the same education as people who had the opportunity to go to better schools.
But they knew what the effect would be.
They knew what the effect would be. Also, you know, in the Jim Crow era, they were also administered in discriminatory ways. So if you the questions that were asked to black people on the literacy test were impossible to pass, and the white people would get different questions, or the registrar would look the other way.
Don't think I even knew that.
Yeah, no, they were often different questions. It would often be a spontaneous thing. But my point is they were extraordinarily nimble in finding new ways to prevent people from voting.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point of the Voting Rights Act was to cut that off. What the original Voting Rights Act said was that in states or in locations where there's a history of racial voter suppression, any new voting law, regardless of whether it's racist or not, really regardless of what it does, any new voting rule had to be submitted to federal officials in Washington. They had to check it first to make sure that it wasn't a discriminatory law. And only after this process was called pre-clearance, only after the law had been pre-cleared, was it allowed to go into effect. So the idea is, because they are quicker than the courts, because the vote suppressors are quicker than we can solve the problem through litigation, you have to nip it in the bud. You cut off the laws before they even go into effect, and they don't get into go into effect until someone has looked at them and made sure that there isn't some sort of racist purpose here. So that's why the Voting Rights Act was enacted. It was enacted as and there are other provisions, but that key provision, which is really the core of the law, was enacted to fight that nimbleness that we saw in voter suppressors.
Now, a lot has happened in 51
Indeed.
Years, and that nimbleness has not gone away.
Exactly.
So give us a little bit of a trip from the time machine 51 years ago to present day.
Right.
What have opponents of voting rights been up to?
Yeah. So in recent years, the Supreme Court has done two things that have inflicted a tremendous amount of damage to voting rights. The first is they struck down that preclearance regime that I was just describing. So now, with the exception, there's a very difficult process that can be used to bring states and various places back under preclearance, but it's rarely invoked. So preclearance basically does not exist right now.
And that was really the heart of the Voting Rights
Act. That's right. So, you know, that has freed a lot of states that historically have had to clear their laws with federal officials to just enact new voter suppression provisions and have them go into effect. It has restored the nimbleness that we saw before.
Which gets us back to you've got to litigate.
Right.
And you got to take it to the courts if you want to strike down what you think is a discriminatory law.
Exactly. And that brings me to my second point, which is that on the merits of voting rights cases, this Supreme Court has been very hostile. And I think that the mark of that hostility is a 2008 decision called Crawford, which rejected a challenge to a voter ID law. Voter ID laws are now fairly common. The strict ones require people to show only specific photo IDs at the polls or they're not allowed to vote. Their defenders say that they're necessary to fight voter fraud at the polls. But all the studies, all the data, including investigations conducted by Republican election officials who campaigned and were elected to office on their support of voter ID laws, have found that voter fraud at the polls is only slightly more common than unicorns and dragons.
So again, one of the classic solutions in search of a problem.
Exactly. So it's a problem that does not exist. What voter ID laws do is that they disproportionately target African Americans, Latinos, students, younger voters, low-income voters. Those are the groups who are less likely to have IDs, and those are also groups which tend to prefer Democrats to Republicans. So it's an effort to shift the electorate to the right, and to do so by targeting very clearly identifiable groups.
So that's one of the decisions that you describe that makes this particular Supreme Court hostile
right.
to voting rights. Anything else that they've done that has been particularly notable?
I mean, there's been a number of smaller but still significant decisions. You know, there's in the lead up to the 2014 election, they handed down a lot of decisions saying, like, we won't let courts strike down voter suppression laws too close to an election, because it's more important to, like, prevent confusion close to elections about what the law is than actually protect people's right to vote. It has historically been a very hostile court to voting rights. The Roberts Court has. What changed is that conservatives no longer have a majority. It is now a 4-4 court instead of a 5-4 court. And so it is likely that they do not have the votes anymore to prevent these voting rights, these voter suppression laws from being struck down. And at the same time, here I said there was an orgy of good news.
Yes, back to the orgy.
Yes,
get
back
us back
to the
to
orgy.
Something I'd never imagined saying on radio, but now I have.
I mean, you always want to get back to the orgy.
Do you? I mean, I guess you do.
Yeah. So, you know, getting back to the orgy, we've had several very good, in just the last 2 weeks, several very good voting rights decisions from lower courts. We had one court of appeals decision striking down really a comprehensive voter suppression law that was enacted in North Carolina. A voter ID law in Texas was struck down. You had in Wisconsin, the voter ID law in that state was more or less hobbled. And part of the story of why I think you're seeing this happen and why I think these decisions are going to have staying power is because if this had happened a year ago, before Justice Scalia died and before conservatives lost their majority on the Supreme Court, then we would all be saying, well, these decisions are nice, but chances are we're going to lose in the Supreme Court and then we're going to be back to the voter suppression regime that we were in. Now the conservatives don't have the votes, and so it's likely that these lower court decisions are going to be the last word on these laws.
So break down what these decisions actually mean. So you mentioned one of them is North Carolina,
yeah.
Another is Texas, two are out of Wisconsin.
Right.
What did these courts hold, and what's particularly significant about what they mean?
So I think the North Carolina law is a testament to the arrogance of a lot of lawmakers who, seeing the Supreme Court's hostility towards voting rights, felt that they could get away with more or less whatever they wanted. I mean, the history here is literally the day after the Voting Rights Act was gutted by the Supreme Court. One of the leaders in the North Carolina legislature said, "We want to do a comprehensive omnibus voting law," and they. Not only did they come up with like a long list of voter suppression provisions, many of which mapped voter suppression provisions that had been enacted in other states, but they sort of compiled them all together into one law. But then they did something else. This is really extraordinary. The legislature literally requested data on racial voting patterns. So they sought out data on like what sort of IDs do black people have? How do black people normally cast their votes? How do white people normally cast their votes? And then they amended their own bill using that data so that they could specifically target voting practices that were common in the African-American community.
Oh, I love this.
So like they found that black people were more likely to use certain forms of ID. So they said that those forms of ID couldn't be used as photo ID in order to cast your vote. They found that black people were especially likely to vote in a particular week of the early voting period. So they cut that week. You know, there's a particular voter registration process that black people are especially likely to take advantage of. So they eliminated that voter registration process. I mean, and then on top of that, the one thing that they didn't touch is they didn't touch absentee voting. And the reason they did it...
Wonder who might be absentee voters,
yeah,
huh?
As it turns out, the reason why is because white people were especially likely to get to vote absentee.
Funny about that.
Yeah. So literally, they looked at like... Let's find out how black people vote, and then let's systematically enact a series of provisions to prevent them from doing it. That's what this law did, and the federal appeals court called them out on it pretty hard.
There's a quote that you pull. Actually, I have to give you some props for a piece that you wrote about this decision, right? You actually summarize the decision in a single GIF. Jeremy Slevin, I have changed how I pronounce GIF. I used to say GIF. I'm now saying GIF for you.
GIF is correct.
Folks can confirm, and it is Jeremy Slevin who gets credit for having caused me to change my ways. There we go. I've said it on air. But you summarize the decision in a single GIF, and it's the incredible Hulk basically slamming the crap out of, I don't even know who that is.
That is Loki in the Avengers.
Well, there we go. There we have it. And you describe it as a beatdown. Why was it a beatdown?
It was just, well, it was a beatdown because the facts were so egregious. I mean, it was what are those cases where, like, you know, I mean, when you read a judicial opinion, they're all laid out in the same way where, like, the judge spends a few paragraphs describing what the issue is, and then they explain the facts of the case, and then they do some legal analysis. And every opinion is laid out in the exact same way. And normally you're halfway through the opinion before you know what the answer is. Before with this case, you're on the third page and she's describing, oh, yeah, and then they requested all of this data and used it to make the laws even more racist. Oh, yeah. And like they did this the day after the Voting Rights Act was struck down, or at least the one key provision of it was struck down.
You pull out a quote, which is just amazing. It's hard not to come away with the conclusion that North Carolina's lawmakers wanted to get caught engaging in unlawful racial discrimination.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that it's yeah. The whole thing is the law is a testament to the arrogance of these lawmakers.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they thought that they had the Supreme Court on their side, and so they could get away with the most blatant attempts to engage in racial voter suppression. And, you know, the sad truth is that if Justice Scalia were still alive, they were probably right.
I will not make comments about people who are no longer with us, but for four court that we have, the landscape has changed, as you noted. So that's one piece of the orgy, mm-hmm. but the orgy continues.
The orgy does continue.
It takes us to Texas. What happened in Texas?
So Texas, I mean, this was the most surprising of these cases. So Texas is overseen by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit is a hellhole for liberals. I mean, like, literally, like, there is a group of attorneys general who have a very conservative litigation strategy, and they always join together and file cases. And like because they represent a bunch of states, they could basically pick where they want to file them. And they always file them in Texas. And the reason they always file them in Texas is because a case that's decided in Texas appeals to the Fifth Circuit. Mm. And the Fifth Circuit, I mean, it's not just that it's conservative. It's that like there are members of the court who are aggressively nasty in their conservatism. I mean, it's really it is not a place where you want to be if you're advocating for something like voting rights. And the full Fifth Circuit, which is itself an unusual process, heard a challenge to Texas's voter ID law, and in a 9-6 decision, said that, yeah, this law is really messed up. And what this law does is it makes it harder for black people to vote, makes it harder for Latinos to vote. And it doesn't actually accomplish anything because this voter fraud you keep telling us about doesn't actually exist. In fact, I think at one point they asked the state, can you point to an example of voter fraud somewhere in Texas? And the state couldn't do it.
So it's particularly significant that this decision comes out of this court.
Right. Yeah. It's a really big deal. I think it speaks to the arrogance that you've seen from these lawmakers believing they could get away with anything.
Because this is the Fifth Circuit.
Yeah. Right? In the Fifth Circuit, like if there is a way to reach a conservative result, the Fifth Circuit will reach a conservative result. And here they said, no, we have to say that this is beyond the pale.
So now take us to Wisconsin to mm-hmm. wrap up the orgy.
Sure.
How many times have I said that now in this segment?
More
than I should have.
Every good orgy must come to an end.
Oh, dear. So take us to Wisconsin. There was a voter ID law in Wisconsin that was struck down, some other stuff as well. What happened in Wisconsin?
Sure. So Wisconsin, there's a bit of a history here. So the Wisconsin voter ID case is being heard by a very, very good trial judge, Lynn Edelman. I know him personally. Fantastic judge. Edelman originally struck down the voter ID law in its entirety. And then it went up to the Seventh Circuit, which is a fairly conservative court, not as conservative as the Fifth Circuit, but still pretty conservative. The case was assigned to an extraordinarily conservative panel. They reversed Edelman. So it looked like we were stuck with this voter ID law. It went back down to Edelman, and Edelman said, okay, I can't strike it down in its entirety, but here's what I'm going to do. It may not be unconstitutional as applied to everyone, but it's sure unconstitutional as it's when it's applied to people. And it's sure illegal when it's applied to people who can't actually get IDs. And so my solution is that if you have an ID, fine. The voter ID law applies to you. You have to show your ID. If you don't have an ID, that's fine, too. Here's an affidavit. Just sign this affidavit saying that you don't have an ID and you are who you say you are, and you should be able to vote, and then you can vote. And it's, you know, it's not entirely a hollowing out of the law, but it's a pretty significant blow that's going to go a long way to towards preventing these voter suppression laws, this particular voter suppression law, from having much effect, provided that this doesn't go to another terrible panel in the Seventh Circuit that reverses that decision as well.
So if that's what's been going on in the federal courts, what do we expect to be the next steps? Do we think that any of these cases are going to come before the Supreme Court? And given that we now have a 4-4 court, what do we think would happen if they did?
So if you'd asked me that before yesterday, I would have been extraordinarily optimistic because, you know, in a 4-4 court, if the court evenly divides, that means that the lower court's opinion stands. So long as you win in the Court of Appeals, that's enough. If you have a 4-4 court.
And their decision stands.
Yeah, right. I'm really disturbed by, so yesterday, there was a case that has nothing to do with voting rights. It's a transgender rights case involving this bathroom issue that keeps coming up.
Which we've talked about on this show in the context of HB2 in North Carolina and other circumstances.
Right. School board wanted to have a discriminatory bathroom policy. They wouldn't let a trans student use the appropriate bathroom. The Fourth Circuit said, no, you can't do that.
Which was a really big deal and something that we celebrated on this show and elsewhere.
Yeah, no, it was a very big deal. The school district went to the Supreme Court, and pretty much everyone thought, okay, like, you can go to the Supreme Court, but you don't have the votes.
Right.
And what happened instead is that Justice Breyer crossed over to vote with the conservatives. He wrote a short opinion where he said, I'm not doing this because I think it's right. I'm doing this as a courtesy to the four justices who wanted to grant a stay, which is something that sometimes happens in death penalty cases, because you don't want the person to be executed while the case is still pending.
Sort of a different situation,
yeah,
though.
But yeah, like, no one was going to die here if this stay wasn't granted.
No one was going to die if this kid was allowed to use the bathroom.
Exactly. Like, for the school district, there was literally nothing at stake. It's, you know, this kid gets the full measure of his civil rights and the school district gets to go about his business, or this kid gets discriminated against and the school district still goes about its business. There's literally nothing at stake for the school district.
And yet,
Breyer decides to grant this courtesy vote. I can't imagine why he did it. It is genuinely inexplicable. Like, I'm not using that word as like a way to be punchy. Like, I cannot explain why he did what he did in this case.
Because in a segment where we've used the word orgy as many times as we have, inexplicable is what you would do to be punchy.
I mean, sorry. You know, I'm not using it because it's like a strong word. I'm using it because I can't figure out what's going on here.
Just poking fun.
Right.
Please continue.
Right. What worries me about this, and I mean, I don't think it's likely that Breyer is going to do the same thing in a voting rights case, but if he grants a courtesy vote in these voting rights cases, that means that these voter suppression laws could potentially be in effect in this upcoming election.
It would stay the decisions made
right.
in these cases.
Exactly. And that would be disturbing. Because that would mean that the law would potentially be in effect at a point where the effects of it are irreversible. If you're disenfranchised in the election, it's not like the court can turn around and say, "Oh, just kidding!" Like, you get to cast your vote retroactively, and that guy who was elected because you didn't get to cast your vote. Oh, they're unelected now.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's not how it works.
And this is I've heard a particularly important year because you know people will be voting for like the president
exactly.
and stuff.
Yeah, so it's not you know it's not like it's not like the Supreme Court gets to show up to the White House and say, "Hey, sorry, Donald, like you're gonna have to move out because we made a mistake." That's just not how these things work.
But so not to ask a question I really don't want to know the answer to.
Yeah.
But do we see ourselves potentially with a path to a repeat of 2000?
Potentially. Is that
what might happen if this were to play out the way you're describing?
Well, I mean, this is different than Bush v. Gore because, I mean, Bush v. Gore was a situation where the election had already happened and the question was how the votes would be counted.
But yeah. I guess what I'm terrifyingly yeah. laying out in my head, and I would love for you to tell me this yeah. is not what you're saying, but is that we end up in a situation where there are a whole bunch of people who aren't allowed to vote
right.
and someone gets elected and it ends up going up to the Supreme Court in some form or fashion.
Yeah. Well, here's the terrifying like Bush v. Gore scenario is that because the Senate refuses to confirm anyone to fill the vacant seat, we have an even number of justices. And so you could conceivably have a case where there's an undecided election. It goes to the Supreme Court. The court splits 4-4. And I mean, it wouldn't remain undecided. What would happen is that whatever the lower court says stands. But parties are going to engage what's called forum shopping, where they're going to shop around for the lower court that's most favorable to them. In some cases, you could potentially have conflicting lower court decisions where, you know, one party might go to the state court because they think that the state court will be favorable to them. The other might go to the federal court because they think the federal court will be favorable to them. You could get two entirely different outcomes and the Supreme Court can't resolve it because they're split 4-4. So, you know, you could have, you know, something distinct from the nightmare of Bush v. Gore, where the Supreme Court declared the loser of the election effectively the winner. You could have a situation where the Supreme Court can't even say that someone is the winner.
I'm actually, my jaw is on the floor, mm-hmm. which is why, uncharacteristically, I am quiet right now. I will pick my jaw back up off the floor. And we will all knock on wood that is not what we see happen. So I guess maybe ending on a more positive note and backing away, and we'll get in our time machine and go back to 5 minutes ago, backing away from sort of that scenario, if we find ourselves in the position where these cases do remain the law of the land, are you optimistic that that is going to do anything to stop opponents of voting rights from continuing to pass these kinds of laws in the future?
Well, so here's the thing. I mean, I go back to where I started with how creative and nimble and dynamic voter suppressors have been. Like, you know, for now, these laws are struck down. But if there isn't some kind of a consequence, then there's no motivation on the part. In fact, lawmakers still have every motivation to come up with new ways to suppress the vote because their job may literally depend on it. You know, I mean, there are lawmakers in North Carolina who will win their election if not very many black people turn out to vote and will lose it if lots of black people
yeah.
turn out. So
yeah.
like their job depends on finding ways to suppress the vote. And that's why we need a regime like the Voting Rights Act in place, like the full Voting Rights Act.
With preclearance.
Exactly. And there is a mechanism to do that. Section 3 of the Voting Rights Act provides that if a jurisdiction has engaged in intentional race discrimination in voting and they have a pattern of that, they can be brought back under the preclearance regime. So in a state like North Carolina, the Court of Appeals declined to do this, but I think that it would be appropriate for the Supreme Court to step in and say, yeah, that's not right. Like these guys engage in systematic, intentional voting discrimination on the basis of race. And the remedy is that North Carolina now needs to have adult supervision.
Ian Millhiser, the justice editor at Think Progress and the author of a book whose title I will not repeat one more time.
Injustices, the Supreme Court's History of Comforting the Comfortable and Afflicting the Afflicted.
Will, I'm sure, keep an eye on these cases for us and come back with an update when we need one. But happy Voting Rights Act anniversary, Ian. And I'm sure we'll have you back on the show soon.
Thank you so much.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe, one where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. Since women joined the workforce en masse after World War II, it's become impossible for families to manage the demands of childcare, elder care, and health care on their own time and dime. But workplace policies have not changed to reflect this.
Policies like universal child care, scheduling predictability, and paid family leave can do a lot to address the work-life conflict across the income spectrum, promoting economic equality for low and middle-income families, and ultimately making our economy more productive. To discuss her recent book and all of these issues, we have on a friend of CAPS, a former CAPPer, Heather Boucher. She's the executive director and chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth, and she's the author of Finding Time, The Economics of Work-Life Conflict. Heather, thank you so much for joining the show.
Well, I cannot tell you how thrilled I am to be here at CAP today to talk to you about these issues. So this is just quite a treat. So thank you.
Well, just a brief question. Was there a radio studio at CAP when you were here?
Yes, there was. It was in exactly the same place.
So we really are welcoming you home.
Yes. The more things change, the more things stay the same.
Exactly. The table seems different, but other than
that is true. That is true. They got us this anthropology looking. It looks like straight out of an anthropology catalog. I always say that.
It's true. So the book is Finding Time, The Economics of Work-Life Conflict. Can you just tell us a bit about the book and why you wrote it?
Well, so I'm an economist, and I've spent my career looking at what's been happening to America's middle class, what's been happening to America's families, and trying to understand the economics behind that. And in the early 2000s, I increasingly came to the conclusion that part of what was happening to American families was that they were not just strapped for income, but they were also strapped for time. And so I've spent the last decade looking at the kinds of policies and the economics around family economic well-being and the role that time plays both in our economy, but also for America's families. And that sort of is the genesis of the book. I spend the first half talking about the problem, the little economics in the middle, and then the second half is talking about a series of policy solutions.
So you open your book with sort of the birth of the New Deal and the social programs created through that, and also just kind of a history lesson, right, about Frances Perkins, obviously the first woman to hold a cabinet position as Secretary of Labor in the 30s through part of the 40s. But you describe something called a family wage and its role in the history underpinning a lot of the problem. Tell us a little bit about what this family wage was.
I'm really glad you started there, Rebecca, because, you know, in economics, we often think about an individual's participation in the labor force or an individual's wages. But yet, when you think about what's happening inside, you know, people's lives, we typically live in families, some sort of family unit of some kind. We consume in families, and our labor force participation is mediated by what's happening inside our families. And so that's sort of one point. When I was in graduate school, I learned about this idea of a family wage, and I found it very confusing because what's a family wage? In the literature, it's this idea that, oh, well, you pay someone how much it costs for them to make ends meet. But in reality, our families are very diverse. The number of people, the number of children they're supporting, maybe they're supporting elders or disabled folks. So how much it costs to support a family is going to be different depending on your family circumstances. So there isn't really one family wage. But why do we have that notion? Well, it's because 50 years ago, 100 years ago, you could think of something called a family wage because most families, with small children at least, or children under the age of 15, most families had one breadwinner and they had a full-time stay-at-home caregiver. And that was true whether or not you were rich or poor, up and down the income spectrum. Most families had someone at home to do work and someone, one person, earning a wage. Today, of course, it looks very, very different. Most families do not have a full-time stay-at-home caregiver, up and down the income spectrum, poor or rich. We don't have that. I'm only about one in four families do. And then most families at the top have two breadwinners, and as you go down the income spectrum, increasingly families only have one breadwinner, and that's because they only have one adult. So how do we think about a fair wage, a family wage? How do we think about supporting families as they actually are? Is really the, I wanted to start the book by teeing up those questions. And one more comment on this, it's really important to think about the intersection between how we think about family economics and how we've thought about policy. So in the 1930s, that's when Frances Perkins outlined and helped put into law what are still today the foundations of our labor policy and social policy, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the National Labor Relations Act, and the Social Security Act. And at that time, women had only had the vote for a little bit over a decade. Most families had a single breadwinner. Most families that had children had a stay-at-home caregiver. And our policies reflect that. And while we've tinkered along the edges and we've done some updating, we haven't sort of dug in deep and said, if we were to do that set of policies today, they'd look very different because our lives look very different. And we need to have the courage to actually move that agenda forward.
So not only do these policies and this dynamic that you've described impact families' ability to prosper in society, but it also directly affects our economy. And you have a couple of great quotes that I pulled out that I wanted to read. And you wrote, "What happens inside families is just as important to making the economy hum along as what happens inside firms." And you also wrote, to what you were just speaking about having a stay-at-home parent, you wrote, "For decades, the American wife gave American businesses a big fat bonus. Her time at home made possible the American worker's time at work." So can you describe just how these changing dynamics are affecting the strength of our economy as a whole?
Thank you. And it's funny, at least that second quote, I worked so hard on that sentence. So I'm glad that Tracy, that somebody read it and is quoting it. Makes me that just, oh gosh, I remember working on that. Thank you.
It's resonating. It worked.
It was worth the time.
Yeah,
so
it really helps break down these dynamics that it's like, wow, that really was some unpaid labor going into business.
Exactly. You know, I opened the book in the preface with a poster, a picture of a poster that I have on my, I had my wall when I was here at CAP, and I had on my wall ever since I became an economist, that talks about how the labor movement used to fight for the idea that we had 8 hours for work, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what we will. And when you think about that motto, you realize that there's all this hidden labor that isn't there, right? Unless what we will includes childcare and doing the laundry and making lunch and grocery shopping and cleaning and all of the other things that happen inside families. And you start to realize that, you know, for generations, firms could look at an employee and they could say, oh, well, Tracy's here in the workplace, but that almost the assumption is that you've got somebody at home that's taking care of all of life's responsibilities. And so I don't have to worry about making you stay an hour late or, you know, worry that you're going to need time off when your kid is sick because you got somebody who can handle that. That's not the case anymore. And that gave American business a big fat bonus because there's a lot of things they didn't have to worry about. And managers and bosses have to worry about that now. It's important because it's important for keeping their employees at work. It's important for productivity. And of course, it's also important for demand, right? People have jobs so that they can buy the goods and services that firms create. That's what an economy is. And, one of the things that just bugs me when I'm hearing people talk about the economy is that so often you hear people talk about the economy as though it were just businesses. Mm. What's good for business? Because they're the quote unquote job creators. And it's like, well, certainly businesses are a critically important part of our economy. But without employees to hire and without people to sell their stuff to, you don't have an economy. It's only if you only look at what is in the interest of business in the short term, you are really limiting your notion of what's good for the economy and in a way that is going to be highly inaccurate. So you have to take into account all the pieces of the puzzle.
Right. So these stay-at-home wives of yesteryear were job creators, essentially. They were, you know, the original job creators. And now that they're not playing that role, policy has to step in and fill that gap.
I also like another, just because we're going to keep reading your book to you.
Yeah.
This is our
yeah.
quiet reading time.
We're just going to read to Heather Boucher on the radio. You
also have another just fantastic sentence that's so perfectly captures a lot of what was going on, which is that American businesses used to have a silent partner, right? And it isn't just the businesses, it was the husbands, right? And what you're describing with that silent partner is that traditional stay-at-home wife who, yes, there are still some stay-at-home moms. We're not trying to say this is not something that exists today, right? We don't want to pick a fight with the Romneys today, at least not today. But I feel like that so perfectly captures a lot of what you've been talking about and what gets ignored and left out of the picture.
Exactly. And it's on both sides, right? And so these two quotes, what we're talking about here, it's that not having that silent partner at home affects businesses and it also affects families. And so being the economist here, thinking about these issues, trying to elevate this, that it's not just that some families are feeling strapped for time because they voluntarily don't have somebody at home. It's looking at the economics that most families need that labor power of women in the workforce, and many women want to work, so there's that as well, but that loss of time affects the quality of family life and it affects the quality of labor supply. And those are two critical economic issues. They're not just about, as I often think, they don't just belong on the style pages of the newspaper. They belong on the business pages as well.
Mm-hmm. So part of this sounds like a culture shift that's needed because you said, well, you know, businesses need to realize that their employees don't necessarily have someone at home, you know, caring for their kids when they get off of school and all of these things. Is there a role for business to change or is it completely policy driven?
I think that there's enormous, there's an enormously important role for business culture in all of this. And, you know, one of the policy areas that you've seen businesses really making the most headway is in areas around scheduling and giving people the ability to have some flexibility in when they work or where they work or how they work. So you see a lot of employers, especially at the high end, giving their workers flexibility in what time they show up, or maybe they are allowed to telecommute one day a week or something like that. And I have in one of the chapters of the book, I have just tons of examples from good businesses that have done this. Of course, not every business has, and that's where policy has to play a role to make sure that this is fairly distributed. It turns out that workers who are at the high end of the wage spectrum are much more likely to have an employer that gives them a predictable schedule, much more likely to have an employer that gives them workplace flexibility that works for the worker. But even those workers at the top who have flexibility then may have to struggle with, well, my employer gave me what we used to have BlackBerries, but now I guess we have iPhones or whatever, but gave me an electronic device, but now I'm constantly tethered to the workplace. And so I have to take calls at 11 p.m. or I have to work on Saturday from the soccer game or whatever. And that's not giving people time for family either. So making sure that when employers are stepping up, that they know about best practices and they're thinking through all of the implications. I mean, these are new policy areas. So it's great to see employers experimenting, but one of the roles that government can play is helping to expand that to more folks.
Now, a lot of what you've described, I think, for people who are maybe at that higher end of the spectrum, who maybe are working from the soccer game or taking those 11 o'clock calls, I have no idea how that feels, although not the soccer game part. No kids here. But I think that there's a tendency to hear this discussion and to understand it as just what would be nice, what would allow me to just spend a little more time with my kids and my husband. Is that what you're talking about, or is it something that has farther-reaching consequences of an economic sort?
Oh, it has much deeper consequences. It's not just nice. Just like having the minimum wage isn't just nice. Just like having the Fair Labor Standards Act that gives us the 8-hour day isn't just nice. Or just like having the retirement security of Social Security isn't just nice, right? These are basic labor standards. So a couple of things. So first, did you know that the United States now has lower labor force participation for both men and women than most other of our economic competitors in the developed world? And economists have been finding that that is in no small part due to the fact that we don't give workers the supports they need to show up ready to work. We don't give them paid family medical leave. We don't give them paid sick days. Mm-hmm. We don't give them scheduling predictability. All of those affect labor supply and the quality of what, as an economist, we would call quote unquote human capital. That is, you know, is the skilled person showing up well-rested, ready to go, focused at work. Giving workers the ability to have some control over the boundary between work and life affects, you know, whether or not you have that job, can keep that job, show up ready to be productive. So that is a big economic piece of this puzzle.
Now, there are some business leaders and some politicians who will say, well, the policies you just described are actually bad for business. Businesses can't afford it, and the government actually can't afford it either. How would you respond to critics of these policies?
Well, my conclusion after working on this book is that we certainly cannot afford not to do this. So first and foremost, for any single business at a moment in time, adopting a new policy is always going to entail a transition. Transitions are challenging and hard. Okay, so that's a thing. But once you scratch the surface and you move beyond the identifiable, easily quantifiable short-term cost, you see that there are all of these short, medium, and long-term benefits for businesses, and there are all these sort of hidden benefits and some hidden costs that are a little bit harder to quantify but are just as important. So a couple of examples. Paid sick days. Here's one where businesses are, you know, have said, oh, this is going to be horrible. This is going to, you know, be really bad for my business. But in fact, what most people who have paid sick days only take about 3 days a year on average. So that's not a really big expense for most businesses. But it also means that people who are sick aren't at work spreading their illnesses to other employees, lowering productivity for lots of people, and perhaps making their customers sick, so lowering demand for that firm. You also have people who have the time to get better, so they're showing up, they're more productive. You don't have them just showing up in their seat but really napping at their desk or having an error, breaking something, doing something wrong. So once you look at all those costs, it's actually good for business. Another area where we see this this claim is around paid family medical leave. In the book, I did a little fun sort of investigative journalism kind of thing where I looked at a bunch of quotes that businesses had made in California before the paid family medical leave law was passed in California, which was in the early 2000s. And so there were a number of businesses and business leaders that said, you know, basically the sky would fall. And this one business owner in particular who owned a restaurant said, oh, well, we will definitely go out of business. This will be just devastating. And it was a very compelling quote.
And how's that business doing today?
Yeah.
So I see where this is going.
Exactly. 7 years later, doing great. And in fact, doing so great that he was able to sell his business successfully to another small business owner who'd also been in business over that whole time period, who obviously had also been so successful that he was expanding. So really, there's not a lot of evidence. And in fact, in California, although there was this huge cacophony, this was going to be bad for business, researchers have found that about 9 in 10 employers have said after the law was implemented, yeah, it was a non-event. It was either good for business or wasn't bad. So those are pretty good, solid economic numbers there.
So it's mostly people are just anticipating the sky is going to fall and it doesn't actually happen. Why do you think, though, it still resonates with conservative politicians in particular to say this in the face of, you know, all this evidence?
I think that we live in an era, especially, we know that we live in an era of rising inequality. We know that we live in an era where the middle class has been squeezed. We know that median family income today is about the same as it was almost 20 years ago. And people, especially in many parts of the country that have been sort of decimated by the demise of manufacturing, people are anxious about having and keeping a good job. And so I think anytime somebody stands up and says, a business leader says, oh, well, this is going to be a job killer, people, you know, get a little fearful. On the other hand, we know that this agenda around work-life policies, paid leave, paid sick days, workplace scheduling, predictability and flexibility, childcare, elder care, all of this is enormously popular among both people on the left and the right, conservatives and liberals. And the only thing that really seems to push people off that support is the fear about job loss. And I think some of it is that we haven't had a lot of economic evidence, but now we do. And so now's the time to start talking about it.
So this agenda, which often gets diminished and described as women's issues, but I think for all the reasons you've talked about, really are broader economic issues and issues that impact all families. It's one where there's been a lot of discussion in this particular election cycle about, you know, these issues and the importance of an agenda in the next Congress and the next White House to tackle these problems. But in the meantime, the states have not waited. And we've seen a lot. In fact, actually earlier this week, Massachusetts enacted an incredibly robust equal pay law that prohibits employers from asking their prospective employees for their salary histories, which can really disadvantage women. So tell us a little bit about what the states have been up to and whether we can learn from them as we look forward to the next White House and next Congress.
Well, so one of the things that I realized as I was nearing completion of the book, and this just sends chills down my spine every time I think about it, every single policy idea that I talk about in this book is actually being tested and has been put in place somewhere in the United States by either a county, a state, or a city, or at the federal level. Well, not really at the federal level, but, you know. And through executive orders is sort of what I was thinking mm-hmm. about. And that is an amazing amount of progress we've made just over the past decade. And in fact, often when I'm in different economic circles and people are feeling like, oh, we haven't made any progress on any policy issues in a long time, I'm like, no, we have made so much progress on these issues, probably more so than almost any issue area, because it's compelling and it's good economics. And so it gives me a lot of hope. But it also means, as an economist, there's all these things we can study now. We actually can tell you, not based on ideology or what I might think, I can tell you this is what paid family leave looks like because we have it in place in California, New Jersey, Rhode Island, and now soon to be put in place in New York State. We have paid sick days now in over two dozen, I want to say it's three dozen now. I think it's almost three dozen places now have paid sick days in place. The number keeps changing so fast I can't keep my notes up.
It's a good problem.
It's a great problem. And we know that the places that have done it have not seen negative economic implications at the level of geography in which it was implemented. So the places that have done it have still seen robust job growth and wage growth, and it's improved quality of life for people. We've seen legislation around predictable schedules and right to request, that is the ability to ask your employer for a schedule that works for you without fear of retaliation, put in place in Vermont and San Francisco. And we've seen, of course, so many places experimenting with programs around universal pre-K and childcare and other ways to support families that have to deal with care This isn't just it's a very exciting time for progress in these issue areas. And I think that's why you've seen it bubble up in the presidential cycle. I mean, for a while, it was very exciting because both Democrats and Republicans were talking about this. So I personally was very sad when Rubio had to drop out because he was talking about paid family leave. And that was very exciting to see this move beyond at the federal level a partisan issue and truly be a bipartisan issue.
And so with all of these policies building at the local and state level, how do you feel about our prospects about getting things through Congress. I obviously, you know, it's been a place that is where policy goes to die. Like, we've talked a lot about policies here, but, you know, you're in Washington, D.C. You obviously spend a lot of time looking at Washington politics. Do you think that this is a changing tide?
Well, I if I wasn't an optimist, I think it'd be very difficult to work in Washington, D.C. for as long as I have.
And particularly on these issues. We share that feeling.
I remain incredibly optimistic. I was very excited when Donald Trump's daughter talked about, Ivanka Trump talked about paid leave at the RNC. And of course, Hillary Clinton has made paid family leave and childcare a part of her platform. So it seems to me that there is some momentum there. Now, Congress, it's really difficult at this moment in time to have a clear sense, at least from where I sit, to know what Congress is going to look like come January. And you know, how this election will play out. But certainly I do think that there's a lot of pressure on members to address the very real economic issues facing families and addressing their time squeeze and the ability for them to find time to care for their families while being able to participate in the labor market it's such a profoundly important issue that I know that everyone is hearing about this from their constituents. So that gives me hope that because these are real issues, that we will be able to see progress.
And I think that it helped also, what was it, earlier this year or last year when Paul Ryan was talking about needing to have his work-life balance. So hopefully it is infiltrating Congress a little bit more.
Well, maybe he can lead the charge.
Exactly. He's a huge fan of, as we like to say on the show, paid leave for himself and no one else.
Yeah.
one conversation, and actually before I even go in that direction, I have to say, for folks who are our listeners and who, you know, maybe don't know all of our colleagues, there's something in the water at CAP right now because everyone is having babies. Everyone is either on maternity leave, about to go on maternity leave. Someone just went into labor literally like earlier today while we're taping, right? Like that's happening. And what you often hear in conversation with those people is how expensive childcare is, and particularly for very small children, right? So, and that conversation, I think, has really broken through, and there's a lot of conversation and momentum around childcare. But the piece that often doesn't get discussed is those care workers, who they are, what the work conditions are, what the pay is. Tell me, are these issues in tension, or is there a win-win we can find for how to pay care workers adequately and treat them well as workers while also bringing the cost of care down?
I think there have to be solutions there. And I think what's really interesting about the childcare issue is how that transcends where you are on the income spectrum, right? So people at CAP are not, you know, gazillionaires, but they are, you know, for the most part, professionals. And people find it very expensive, even if you have a good paying job. So this is something that just is so imperative to deal with for everyone. The thing that we know about care, childcare and elder care, is that the quality of that care, the outcomes for that child or that person who needs care, the sick or the ailing or the elderly, is directly related to the quality of the care provider, which is typically directly related to pay, working conditions, and of course, training. So if we think that having a well-prepared future workforce, and I don't mean to bring raising children down to just being future good worker bees. I realize that can be offensive to many people.
But that's just one piece of it.
Just to sort of talk about the economics, if we think that that is an important thing, what we know from the science is that the years from 0 to 5 are imperative, that children have access to high quality care, that anyone can provide that. It can be from a parent or it can be from a paid provider. But that provider, if they are not the parent or whomever, needs to have a good job in order to be able to provide that high quality care to that child, which then sets that child up for success later on in life. That's everything. And so we cannot afford to continue to neglect the early childhood care and education workforce, because in doing so, we are neglecting America's children and we are putting in jeopardy the fact that the United States economy has traditionally been successful because we have the best trained workforce in the world. We won't have that if we do not get our act together very quickly. Now, here's the thing. That's going to be expensive. I'm not going to lie to you. But you know what is also expensive? Primary and secondary school. And you know what's also expensive? Community policing. There's lots of things that cost money, and we managed to find a way to do it. We continue to live in one of the richest countries the world has ever seen. And if we cannot find a way to pay for the things that are imperative and important, then we as an economy and a society will not be successful. So there you go.
Heather Boucher with a warning for anyone who's listening. The cost of doing nothing is high. You heard it here first. You will hear it again the next time we have her on the show. Heather Boucher is the executive director and the chief economist at the Washington Center for Equitable Growth. We look forward to having you back on Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much. What a treat.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the We Act Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food.